KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
nut. How you doing?
Doing good, man. I'm sitting here in Lindsborg, Kansas. How about you?
I'm in Ojai, California. I'm not going anywhere. My tours are postponed until 2022 and 2023, but you're not in Ketchikan. What's that about? You're still on...
I'm an artist in residence here in Kansas, and, you know, I'm in the other big K-town, or K-state. Wait. All right, yeah. Anyways.
Wait a minute.
I'm in Kansas. I'm in Kansas, and I'm having fun here at Lester Raymer's Red Barn Studio.
That's so awesome. And do you miss the horizontal rain and the beautiful old growth forests?
I'm only about 2 weeks into this, and no, I don't miss it so much. It's nice to actually have a break. But, you know, today the weather changed, and it's in the 70s. It's quite pleasant. So,
oh, awesome. Yeah. Well, you know, it's conversations really get dull when you start talking about the weather.
So do podcasts, man.
Now, I got a question here. We are paleo nerds, right?
Yes, we are.
Now, the opposite of the paleo diet is what kind of diet?
All right, that's the vegan diet or the...
Well, yeah. It's kind of less animal protein. But you had your very first experience of a Beyond Burger, Impossible Burger last night?
Well, that's right. I did tell you that before. And yes, Michelle and I made a couple of Impossible Burgers. And I got to say, we're converted, man.
What did I say? Well, I mean, they're really indistinguishable.
They're really tasty. I couldn't really tell the difference. Michelle says she caught a difference. But, you know, they were tasty. They were really good. So
I love it. I don't think I'll ever buy ground beef again. And you know that the greatest contribution to global heating is that 40% of our land mass is being used to cultivate beef. And it's just a waste, and so much carbon.
Well, yeah. But I got to say, there's one thing about the Impossible Burger that I found a little off-putting was...
Me too.
It came
too.
In a the giant plastic thing.
Plastic packaging.
It's like
what's that about?
Plastic and little... It's like, whoa.
There's a thing there, man. Very, very angry about that. So,
that's right,
Let's write letters. Okay. So, good. I'm glad that you are converted. And, they sell ground Impossible Burger so you can make spaghetti and all that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll look for that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. So, paleo news.
In paleo news, Dave, there was this cool creature that was found right next to the Burgess Shale, about the same age, 508 million years or so. Have you heard about Titanocoris?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if I'm just because I'm a nerd, I get it in my news feed. It came in about 10 times over 2 or 3 days. It's this giant shield-like creature with crab-like front bits.
It looks like a swimming taco shell with arms.
Yes. Upside-down taco shell.
That's right, upside-down taco shell with arms, but it is it's a predator, and it's big, Titanocoris. And you know that we referred to it earlier in one episode I saw. You know, they've been working on this for a few years, but they finally published it.
Right. And so this thing is a predator, and it's big compared to the Burgess Shale creatures, which are like, you know, 3, 4, 5 centimeters. They're tiny, most of the Burgess Shale, except for Anomalocaris was the biggest one until
Titanocoris.
Titanocoris.
So this is swimming around in the water column with Anomalocaris, too, munching on those.
How big was Anomalocaris?
Munching on trilobites and stuff, man. Anomalocaris, about a meter long is the biggest they've got.
3 feet.
So it's 3 feet. Okay. Although I think they've got hints of bigger ones from China about the same period. But yeah, so that's pretty mind-blowing. This big animal that they didn't know was there. So
Yeah. But you know what's great is a discovery will take place 10 years ago. It'll take 3 or 4 years to excavate it out of the matrix, and then 3 or 4 years to write a paper and finally publish it. So it's funny, these brand new discoveries are sometimes 10 years old.
Well, that's kind of the scientific process. So we saw pictures of this animal a few years back, you know, somebody like
right.
And like, ooh, what is that? So, for instance, I saw a picture of a shark on the web the other day, Tychodus. And I'm so excited. Tychodus fossils are found everywhere, and they finally found a complete one. They've been finding the teeth of this giant shark for a long time, like here in Kansas. And, right. And nobody knows what shape the body was, and they finally found a beautiful specimen. So I'm waiting for that one to come out. I'm excited about that.
Cool. Very cool. Very cool. And I'm excited for today's guest because today's guest, her studies, Julie Meachin, her studies represent moments in time. I love when a moment, a fossil is a moment in time, a Thursday at 2 p.m.
Well,
I love that idea. And you're looking at me like...
I don't see how a giant hole in the ground that traps animals for tens of thousands of years is a moment in time. It's a lot of moments in time.
Yeah, but I'm going to ask her. I'm sure that some animal fell in, broke its leg, didn't die that minute, but lingered for a week and then died in a death position. I know that a lot of the bones are disarticulated, but they have found some complete skeletons, and I want to ask her about that.
And we're talking about the natural trap cave in southern Wyoming, and we're going to get right to that. But first off, I want to get a little of her background story. She's a very interesting scientist, and she's at Des Moines University. So,
yeah.
Shall we call her up, Dean?
Yeah, let's call her up. I've got one can with a piece of string, and I've put it all the way over to Des Moines, Iowa.
Des Moines, Iowa. Call her up, Ben. Hey, Dave, meet Julie Meachin, vertebrate paleontologist and associate professor of anatomy at Des Moines University. So, hey, Julie, nice to meet you, and meet my friend Dave.
Hey, great to meet you both.
Yeah, hi, Julie. The real question is, at the top of this interview, are you a paleo nerd?
I am a paleo nerd, of course.
Yay! Well, we like that. You're proud to be a paleo nerd, too, I'll bet, huh?
I am. I love paleontology.
So when did that whole thing start for you? Or were you a dinosaur-loving kid like me? Or?
Oh, my goodness. So that's really funny. I actually was not a dinosaur-crazy kid. I have always been a mammal-crazy kid.
Oh.
So from the time that I was a little tiny kid, when I was super young, I grew up in Chicago, and my folks used to take me to the Field Museum. And the dinosaurs weren't my biggest favorite thing. The thing that I really loved were the taxidermied animals.
Me too.
Yes.
The halls of taxidermy. I spent my high school years in Chicago, so I have that same Field Museum experience.
Yeah, so I've always been mammal crazy. Always been a mammal girl.
So like the dioramas, the bison, the pronghorn leaping, and that's what got you into it. So the love of mammals, and then you went to Mammal University or something? Well, you studied mammals as an undergrad or what? What happened?
I'm
fast-forwarding here.
It was kind of a windy road, actually. I thought, you know, as a kid, I didn't know I could be a mammal paleontologist. I thought the only thing you could do with mammals was be a vet. And so I actually went to a special high school to train at a vet's office. And after I did that, I realized I didn't want to be a vet. So I was kind of confused when I started college. I went to the University of Florida.
Okay.
I was confused about what I wanted to do. I knew I still wanted to work with animals, but I knew I didn't want to be a vet. So I actually saw an ad for help wanted in the vertebrate paleontology collection at the Florida Museum.
Really?
And I was like, oh my God. I think that's what I want to do. And so, funnily enough, I did not get the job, but I started volunteering.
At the Museum of Paleontology there?
Yes. And after that, I was hooked. Just hooked.
Wow. But actually, back in the childhood, for just 1 minute, being a mammal crazy person, loving these dioramas, did you have all kinds of cats and dogs at your house? Are you a mammal keeping person?
I am now. I have two big dogs. I love dogs. My parents always had dogs. And then I also had a cat as a kid. But I think we never had a menagerie, and that was mostly, you know, due to my parents. They didn't want all the pets.
Good.
So, but I always loved animals. I loved all kinds of
animals.
So
then you didn't stuff your family pets then?
No, I didn't.
That'd be kind of... So at the university there, I know that when I was reading up a little bit on your background, you got to go out in some paleo digs, and on one of your first digs, You found a giant ground sloth, but it's actually the biggest ground sloth ever found. Is that true?
I don't know if it's the biggest, but it's one of the biggest. It's wow. I think it's an Eremotherium. It's on display at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Oh.
And so that was one of the first major paleo digs that I participated in. It was so much fun.
But Florida being basically a giant sand decay, what kind of deposition would this sloth be in that would preserve it?
So it was in a limestone quarry, and it was a lot of clay. Oh. A lot of clay. So sort of clayey, silty sediment. And Florida is actually really well known for its mammal fossils, for its Pliocene and Pleistocene mammal fossils. So this was, you know, par for the course for a Florida dig, and it was great. It was super awesome.
Eremotherium is so cool, the big claws and all that, you know. Wow. And then you ended up out of the Hagerman fossil beds at some point, too. Can you tell us what the Hagerman fossil beds are?
Yeah, so Hagerman is a site out in Idaho near Twin Falls. It's a national monument. And it's basically like a bunch of sand dunes. It's a bunch of sandy hills, and then the fossils are found in these little blowouts that you basically have to prospect. So you basically are walking up and down these sand dunes looking for any trace of a fossil, and then when you find some, you basically kneel down and you start, you know, excavating a little bit. And they're all Blancan in age, so they're all sort of that Pliocene, late Pliocene age stuff.
Mostly horses, right? Or mostly horses at the Hagerman?
So there's lots of horses there, but they have lots of other stuff too, and they have lots of carnivores as well.
Oh,
yeah.
Is this an ancient freshwater lake shore?
Yes. So that's what they think it was.
Right.
That's what they think Hagerman
right.
was.
That's why the sand dunes.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, before we dive into the big topic that we want to talk about.
No, before we fall into
I see. We're going to fall into the NTC, but more about that in just a moment. But you are teaching at Des Moines University, and basically that's a medical university. So you're teaching doctors, and what's a paleontologist doing teaching at a medical?
She's touching dead people for money, Ray.
That is accurate. I do touch dead people for money.
Oh.
But okay. Actually, it's really amazing that a lot of paleontologists actually teach at medical schools. We're all in anatomy departments. Yeah, and that's because we're one of the only groups of people that are still classically trained in anatomy. The other group being the biological anthropologists. So it's us and the bioanth people that are staffing the anatomy departments at most medical schools.
But you're concurrent in it. That's the thing. You're constantly, you didn't learn it 10 years ago and you're teaching it. You're concurrently studying anatomy.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We just do it every day. So,
it's amazing the number of people that just don't get basic anatomy, and that basically vertebrates are built the same, you know, built in the same body plan and radius, ulna, femur, you know, tibia, fibia.
Well, Ray, if you look at your face, this is your coccyx.
What?
Right
what?
Here. Sorry, I pointed to his. Anyway, let's move on.
Oh man, but I think that is so cool that you're teaching anatomy. And I'm wondering though, do you every now and then like derail some of these young medical students and veer them off into paleontology? Peel them off?
I don't. I wish I could. I've had a couple of students come out into the field with me, and they are so like enamored with it. They love it. But it's more of like a curiosity to them rather than, you know, something they decide they want to do. Well, I mean, they're already in medical school. They've already taken all the exams. They've already passed all the tests. They've already paid all the money. They generally don't change their mind about what they want to do by the time they're here. But they do really find what I do exciting. So, and I have my first thesis master student this semester. So I am training future paleontologists now.
Oh, that's cool.
That's awesome. That is so great. Giving back. All right, Ray. So what is an NTC, Ray?
Natural.
What is the NTC?
Natural Trap Cave. I actually had the opportunity to go there with Dr. Kirk Johnson about the year 2000 or so. And I think one of the scariest things about Natural Trap Cave is actually the road to Natural Trap Cave.
Yes.
That's where I really feared for my life. But we finally got up to this spot, but I should not be the one describing what Natural Trap Cave is. We should let Julie tell us. What is this thing in Wyoming?
So it is an 80-foot deep sinkhole. It's in the limestone, so it's all karst topography up there. And this is a sinkhole that formed sometime before about 110,000 years ago. So we don't know exactly when it formed, but we know it formed before that. Basically, the limestone dissolved underneath this cavern, and it formed this giant bell-shaped cavern. It's at the end of a ridge, so it's basically at the end of a little hill, and then the hill drops down, and there's the hole for Natural Trap Cave. The opening is about 20 feet in diameter.
With a giant metal grate over the top, so we can't fall
right,
in.
Well, now you can't.
I stood on that. That's what I did, yeah.
Oh.
But
did you spit into it?
Oh, Dave, no. I was with a doctor. He said, no, I couldn't do that. But okay. Crazy, it's sort of like a shaped like a beer bottle or something. You know, it's narrow, and then it widens, and then
it
I was able to look down. The road up to it was super scary because you're just, you know, it's like in the cartoons. The truck could go down the hill anytime. But when you get up there, it's basically a big hole into which mammals have been dropping for 100,000 years, right?
Yes. And, yeah, the road is scary. They've actually improved the road, thank goodness. But, yeah, so the inside of Natural Trap is about as big as a football field. It's pretty big inside.
Wow.
Yeah.
How does an animal end up down in a hole? What is the scenario that you envision?
Yeah, so since it basically is a hole that comes right after a big hill, what we envision is basically carnivores chasing herbivores, right? They're sort of running. One's running for their dinner. The other's running for their life. And they're not really paying attention to where they're going. And they come over this little ridge, and they don't see the hole, and in they go. And so we've got lots of carnivores, and that's one of our thoughts, is that almost not quite one-to-one. It's about one carnivore to every three herbivores we have, so it's clearly an event where carnivores are coming in fairly regularly.
And what is the predator-prey relationship in the ecology outside of the cave? What would it be, 1 to 10?
Yeah, probably something more like that. Maybe one carnivore to every 10 herbivores. So there's a high carnivore ratio in
the
cave.
But I thought maybe part of that would be the smell of the cave bringing, like La Brea, bringing predators in.
Ah.
And their curiosity getting like, what's down there?
It could be, although I wonder, I mean, it's so far down, it was probably pitch black looking to most of the carnivores, so they may or may not have decided to jump in. If they did, that would have been a really bad move, because they probably would have broken their legs.
But you mentioned the snow cone of hypothesis. I think that was by Larry Martin, one of the first discoverers or investigators of the cave. Explain the snow cone hypothesis, which would possibly give a predator the ability to get down in there without hurting himself.
Yeah, so the snow cone hypothesis, it was put forward by Larry Martin, was that in the Pleistocene, it would have been much colder, and snow would have accumulated in the cave in sort of a cone fashion because of how snow would fall into a narrow opening and then sort of make this cone shape. And as it turns out, our team, so we're actually publishing a big compendium on Natural Trap Cave in Quaternary International.
Oh, really?
It should come out next year, we're hoping. Cool. But our stratigrapher, Dave Lovelace, and I have been working on this, and we're not sure there was actually a snow cone there. We think water would have done a lot of the movement that they think the snow cone did. So it's possible if a snow cone was there that animals would have had like a cushion to fall on, but we're not so sure there actually was a snow cone.
Oh, that's interesting. If I could, for just a moment, I want to give a shout out to Larry Martin, because I'm back in Kansas, and when I was in high school in Kansas, there was a fellow that hired me to do illustrations for his film strips that he did for local schools.
Remember those?
Yeah, film strips, educational film strips, colorful Kansas films. And this fellow, Harold Caldwell, hired me to be the artist. And Larry Martin was the first scientist to ever actually critique my artwork. And Yes, well, I drew these pictures of mammoths and, you know, and mastodons. And I was only in high school, but we made a journey up to KU to meet with Larry Martin. He was my first paleontologist I ever met, actually.
Oh, wow.
And he was a big guy, you know, and But he also told me that my Pleistocene landscape was maybe incorrect. It's not like today, that I needed more trees and all that kind of thing.
The trunk, but, the trunk goes on the front.
But anyways, Larry was a cool guy, and he was actually very much an expert on short-faced bears and also saber-toothed cats and tigers. But anyways, a shout-out to Larry.
I've got to get back to NTC. I've got so many questions. How deep is the deposition layer, and do you have a date from the earliest to the latest? And then the other thing is, what's the orientation of fossils? Is there a large amount outside the snow cone? If there was a snow cone, is it all directly below the hole? But basically, those three questions: deposition layer, how deep, the date, and the distribution of fossils, because you used a GPS to do that.
We sort of did. GPS doesn't work in the cave. You can use GPS on the surface.
Yeah, you established a point, then you used a surveyor instrument to work around that.
Right. So I would say, so we didn't do most of the excavating for depth. That was mostly done in the 70s and 80s by the Martin Gilbert team. And it's like 9 feet deep. Like, they dug a pit like 9 feet deep, and they were still pulling fossils out.
Wow.
So most of our digging has been, I mean, we've gone down about 3 or 4 feet, I think, in our excavations. And most of our excavations have been on the periphery of their original excavations, because the initial dig pit kind of got filled in with sediment, and it's sort of undiggable. You'd need like a backhoe to get all the sediment out of the main 9 foot deep pit.
Is that directly below the hole?
That's directly below the hole. And so we basically go out on the periphery, and we're still finding lots of fossils. So our stuff has been dated from about 40 to 45,000 years old is the oldest dates we have. And then the youngest dates we have are, we go all the way up to the modern, and we have stuff all throughout the Holocene from like 8,000 years to 3,000 years, and stuff still falls in today. So there's still deposition.
What's the largest recent mammal or animal?
A bison, the largest recent animal is a bison. And that those fell in the Holocene. And then a cow actually fell in prior to the grate being put on in the 70s.
Fell in. See what I did there.
A coyote had fallen in. And then now today, little things still fall in. So we've got pack rats, deer mice, snakes, birds that still fall in.
Wow. So what is the rate of animals falling in, the larger mammals? Is that like once a year? I mean, over 100,000 years, you're seeing, is it like every month there's an animal that goes in? Or do you have any kind of calculation on that?
We don't. And that's simply because we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of everything that's in there. So Xiaoming Wang said that you could dig for 100 years and not get to the bottom. And that's probably true. So we just don't know what the rate of deposition was. But, you know, just given what we know from today's animals, every season when we come back, there's at least 2 or 3 freshly dead animals that are in there. So
2 or 3 a year?
At least.
Are the animals articulated? I mean, these older animals, have they been torn apart by predators? What happens in the cave? What's the scenario? What's it like? Describe what happens as an animal falls in and what's...
I have a question on that. I have a follow-up to that.
I'm asking the question first, Dave. Yield the floor.
I yield.
Okay. So that's a great question. So the animals are not articulated when we find them. And that's been a huge conundrum for us. Like, why? These animals should just fall in and that should be it. There's no predators in there. It's 80 feet deep. We think it actually is. We think there's a lot of water movement. We think there's a lot of movement from precipitation. We think there might have been flowing water in a cavern underneath the cave. And so we think things get broken up by water a lot. And we think that's part of it. There have been a few articulated specimens, and oftentimes we'll find like 2 or 3 bones from the same individual right next to each other, but then nothing else.
Wow.
And with a couple of exceptions, we had a wolverine that's mostly articulated. We have a fox that was almost completely articulated.
A recent wolverine?
No, a Pleistocene wolverine.
Oh.
Do any of them have chew marks on them? Like there was something alive down there? Everything that falls in dies.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, my question is there any evidence of a death pose, any animal that possibly survived the fall and lingered? There's nothing?
So There are some animals in places, there are specimens been found in places in the cave where you would not expect them to be found if they just fell in and died immediately. So
that's so sad. That's so sad.
Natural trap kind of slopes down, and the original excavations dug a test pit at the bottom of the slope and found some stuff. So the thought is that they probably did, like some animals probably did stagger around in there with like broken limbs and possibly starved to death. So yeah, I mean,
it's really pretty. It's a grim, it's a death cave, the cave of death.
It is.
Once you go in, there's no way out, man.
Right, it's true.
There's no way out, there's no exit, right? You fall into this hole, that's it.
Which brings us to the very quick question is you have to rappel in using very expert cavers.
Cavers.
So you have to go in there by rappelling with cave experts that help you get in and out. And then any material has to be pulled out. And how long does it take to get in and how long does it take to get out?
Have you guys camped down there?
We don't camp in the cave. We camp at the surface. Yeah, so I'd like to give a shout-out to our lead caver, Juan Layden. He's basically the guy who helps us with everything. He's our
He's in that video, right? He's a really nice rancher, a Wyoming guy.
He's a Wyoming guy. He's not a rancher, but he is a Wyoming guy. Oh. Yeah, and he's a single rope technique expert, a vertical caving expert. He gets us in and out, and it takes a lot less time to get in. I'd say it takes about, less than 5 minutes to get in. Gravity's helping. And then to get out, it depends on your level of expertise with climbing rope. So Juan and other cavers can get out in about 2 minutes. Yeah, about 2 minutes.
But you're using some sort of a cinch type thing? What's it called?
It's
cinch
an ascender.
Winch?
So basically you use an ascender. Right. So it just goes one way, and then it sort of hangs there. And it's called a frog is how we get out. And it's basically like you're doing squats and thrusts. Like you're basically pushing up, pulling your legs up, and then using your legs to push yourself up again. So
got it.
So I take about 5 or 6 minutes to get out. And people who have a little bit more trouble can take anywhere from 8 to 10.
I was wondering, does anyone ever like freak out going into the cave and then like, I can't handle this. Can I get out of here?
So it's more freaking out on rope. So once they're in the cave, people are usually pretty chill because it's such a big cavern that there's not a lot of claustrophobia. But people have freaked out coming down on rope. But really, people freak out more going up. And we've had to do a few little minor rescues to basically get people out.
I think that would be the case with me. I'd probably be the guy. Wow.
Yeah, I don't like heights either.
Hey, could you tell us what are the creatures that are typically found in the cave? Or walk us through the timeline of the deepest and you see things disappear. Do you find mammoths at the bottom and all the way up or what?
So we basically have a Pleistocene fauna and a Holocene fauna. And our Pleistocene fauna does include mammoths, but we don't have very many of them. And I think that's because mammoths don't run very much.
Right.
Elephants and mammoths don't run. So I think they probably knew the hole was there and avoided it. So I only know of one or two mammoth specimens that were found in the cave.
Yeah.
But we've got lots of other ungulates. We have lots of things that run. So we have pronghorn. We have bighorn sheep. We have lots of horses. That's probably our most numerous animal. And we have two different genera. We have the equus that was there, and we have Harrington hippus, which is the stilt-legged horse.
That's cool.
And we also have camels and bison and Buotherium, which is the muskox.
Ooh.
Nice. Yeah. And we have lots of carnivores. We have the short-faced bear, although not many of those.
Arctotis.
Yeah, Arctotis. And we have lots of wolves. We have lots of American cheetahs, Miracinonyx.
Lots of them, huh?
Lots of them. They and wolves are the two most numerous carnivores we have.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And we have...
Is it the dire wolf?
It's we do have dire wolves, but they're super rare. We really have a lot of the Beringian wolf, which is basically the extinct version of the gray wolf.
Right, Canis lupus.
How about
and
lions?
We have
lions.
You
must have lions.
Yep, we have American lions. And we have, excuse me, we have Wolverines.
Wait, are you telling the truth about the American Lion?
Yeah.
She must be lying.
Ha! I see what...
And that was so bad. That gets edited
that
out.
Was a softball. No, I like that. That was a little softball. I got it. Uh-huh. Julie, you were kind of slow in the uptake there.
Sorry.
I got it. Yeah, right. So, and you must have, besides the short-faced bear, you have black bears and brown bears?
We do not. We don't have any other bears.
Oh.
Wow. That's interesting.
No. We have wolverines, which don't exist in that area anymore. We have...
Or the muskox.
No, the muskox doesn't either, right? We have a couple foxes, and we have we found our first lynx.
Oh, was it missing before that?
Oh, my gosh.
I know this is a dumb question, but you've never found a primate, a human, in there.
Nope.
That would be a big, big deal if you did.
And we'd actually get shut down. So glad we haven't found any humans yet. I'm hoping we don't. Fingers crossed.
Right. So how far deep do you think the deposition goes? I know you said forever, but seriously, what do you think?
Yeah, so...
can you tell by the shape of the sculpting of the inside where a possible cave floor might be?
No, I wish.
Wow.
We just can't. I don't know exactly how far down it goes. The Martin and Gilbert team... hypothesized that they'd find things as old as 110,000 years old toward the bottom of the deposit. We haven't even gotten close. So I don't know. Couldn't say.
Wow. Is most of the original Martin's team, Martin and who else was it?
Miles Gilbert from the University of Missouri.
Did they take all those bones out of there? Where do these bones go in collections? Where are they?
They're at the University of Kansas from the original excavations, and now our excavations from 2014 on are at the University of Wyoming.
Oh, excellent. So they're staying there in the state.
Yes.
So, of course, the big question is, you know, you are able to see with 100,000 years worth of animals piling up, there's an arrival of a primate that happens in North America, a return of primates to North America, i.e. humans, you're able to see the Pleistocene extinction in there and the Great Pleistocene extinction, but you're also looking at climate change as well at the same time with the pollen, right?
Yes.
So it's the big question in paleontology, what caused that big extinction?
Wait, Ray, this is my question.
Well,
I know, Ray.
Maybe you need to modify your question at the end. Well, I'm sure that this is, you are looking at, in your work, you're able to see a change. Is it dramatic or is it gradual, I guess, would be my question. Do you see a change in the fauna, you know, the megafauna disappearing? And you've also got microfossils of smaller mammals and birds and that kind of thing. So I'm sure you're really wondering, you know, we all want to know, what's the change that you see?
So we do see change. Unfortunately, we have some layers missing, much to our chagrin. The extinction event is actually missing. So we've got a 13,000-year date or about a 15,000-year date, and then we don't have anything until about 8,000 years.
What?
Yeah,
why?
I don't know, and this is one of our mysteries that we're trying to figure out.
Did Larry Martin take it?
I don't think so, but you never know, right? No, I'm kidding.
Hey, I'm in Kansas. I'll go check.
Right. So we do see a big change then. We see basically no more megafauna. The only large animal that's still there is a modern bison. And then we see a lot of microfauna. So a lot of the change we see is in the microfauna. We do have a different fauna from the Pleistocene than we have from the Holocene. But it is a gradual change. It is not it's not an abrupt change. So it's clear that the same types of animals are still in the area, but some animals have left or died off, depending upon the climate, the environmental changes. We do see changes in pollen. So we do see these fluctuations in pollen of pine and grass and things like that, the sagebrush, all those things. So we do see changes through time for sure. They're just gradual, I would say, more than abrupt.
In your 40,000 years, can you see the, I think there's four or five glaciations in that time. And you see the ecology of the differences in pollen and microfossils during those Nebraskan, Kansan,
Wisconsinan.
Hello there. Yeah, the Wisconsinonian. How do you say Wisconsinian?
Wisconsinan.
That's the last one. Wisconsinan. Yeah.
Let's all try that.
Yeah. Hey, how about a beer?
A Wisconsin. Yeah.
Yeah. So, do you find the different? Is there evidence of the ecology changing?
There is more evidence from the pollen of the ecology changing than there is from even the microfossils. So basically, the environment there has always been kind of more open and dry. But within that sort of open, dry framework, it has changed a bit over those last glaciations. And we do see that with the pollen.
And do you study phytoliths as well? Is that included in the data?
We have not studied phytoliths yet, no.
But you are able to take the bones and look at the DNA, of course, and yes. You are also able to look at the geochemistry of the bones and see what animals are eating, right?
Yes, yeah, we're doing that. Those studies are underway.
That's really fascinating. Was this, you have risen to the rank of being the director of the digs there, right? Is that?
Yes, yeah, I am the PI. I've always been the PI. Yeah, the lead investigator. So I've always been the lead investigator there. But it's just that we've been doing it for a long time now, so everybody knows about it.
So, well, how does that happen? You were the one who wrote the grant, and you assembled the team.
Yeah. So originally it was me and a colleague from Australia, Alan Cooper, who started this project. And I wrote the grant. Alan wrote the ancient DNA part of the grant. We assembled the team. We got the permits. I got the permits from the Bureau of Land Management. And as the project has gone on, it's sort of blown up into a much bigger project than we initially had had thought of. And as time has also gone on, Alan has dropped off the project. So it's basically just me. And now I actually do have a co-PI who's studying all the microfauna, Jenny McGuire.
Where's Jenny?
She's at Georgia Tech.
What are you finding through the DNA analysis?
So the DNA analyses are really interesting. So one of Alan's former postdocs is in charge of doing DNA analyses now. His name is Kieran Mitchell. And Kieran and I have been working on several different projects. So we've been looking at ungulates a little bit, but we've mostly been focusing on the carnivores, and the wolves are the big thing that we're working on right now. So our project with wolf DNA is underway, and one of the things that came out of that was they found dire wolves there, and we were able to do the dire wolf genome for the Nature paper that came out in, I believe it was December of last year or January of this year, basically showing the dire wolves aren't gray wolves. They're not even closely related to gray wolves. And then the other cool thing is that we're looking at the DNA of the Beringian wolf in North America in the lower 48, which turns out to be different than any wolf DNA out there so far. So
there's like a subspecies between the Beringia wolf and the dire wolf, right? It's a third.
So actually, dire wolves are like a completely different genus now. Million years separated. And so the Beringian wolf is like a subspecies of the gray wolf that came over from Eurasia. And what we're finding is the one that's in Natural Trap Cave is really interesting. And I'm not going to give it away here, but it might be related to coyotes. It might be related to red wolves. So it's kind of cool. We're really excited about it.
That's kind of tantalizing. Wow. You're teasing us now. Huh. Interesting. Wow. How accessible is the cave if a tourist wanted to go, like, look in the cave? Is this all on the down low? You don't want people to... I mean, obviously, I've been there. I was treacherous
Ray,
to get there. But...
But Ray, you stood on the grate. If you want to get into the cave, you have a couple of days of cave
training. I'm not saying that, but I'm just wondering.
And rope.
I'm wondering, with the grant work, there must be some sort of public outreach component to it that you need to let people know about this work. And where would I see an interpretation of the cave, or is there something anywhere near the cave? Is there any interpretive sign work or anything like that? Or is University of Wyoming museum-wise?
So I'll answer your first question first. To get into the cave, you have to have a permit.
Right.
So I have a permit. I'm the only current permit holder. So nobody else besides BLM or me can get into the cave. And so So we basically are the ones, the gatekeepers. I do make people get trained before they go in. Yeah, so the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, has a sign right at the cave. You probably saw it when you were there, but it's really basic. It just describes what the cave is. It doesn't really go into a lot of detail about it. I have been doing outreach. I'm mostly doing it with school age kids. And then we did an outreach paper talking about all the things we've done with school aged kids. For the outreach for the site, that's really up to the Bureau of Land Management. But the University of Wyoming Museum is doing an exhibit on natural traps. So they are eventually going to do an exhibit. Great. Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen my little drawing that I did, 40,000 Mammals Can't Be Wrong.
Yes, I have seen your drawings. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
So I'm just wondering.
We will have that.
Maybe you need a t-shirt at some point, you know, just saying.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I would definitely take a t-shirt.
So I have a really silly question, but it's practical. How many hours would you spend in there during the day? Would it be, 8 to 6 type thing? Obviously, you want sunlight, natural light. But then how do you go to the bathroom? Is there some kind of a... most climbers have bags mm-hmm. that you have to carry out when you're on a wall.
So we spend about 6 hours in there. Actually, it ends up being about 8 with all the getting people in and getting people out.
Right.
And yeah, we have to go to the bathroom in there. And so, hilariously, I make guys bring their own porta potties. They basically bring empty Gatorade bottles they use.
Right.
Gals, we actually
don't confuse. Gatorade.
Don't bring yellow Gatorade down. Like, that's basically the rule, you know? For the gals, we have a litter box. That's what I call it. I call it the litter box. It's a bucket with a garbage bag liner, kitty litter, and a toilet seat on it.
Right.
And so,
great.
So that's what
we use.
That's
great. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, too, how comfortable is it down there? Is it cold or, like, can it get hot or... What happens when it rains?
10 degrees, which is about 47. Wait, what's 10 degrees?
Celsius. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's cooler Celsius. Down there?
It's like 42 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, we're both wrong. 10 degrees Celsius is 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you want to figure this out on your own, the conversion is pretty easy. You basically take your Celsius temperature, double it, and then add 30. You get your approximate Fahrenheit. So, for example... 10 degrees Celsius, double it, is 20 degrees. Add 30, that's 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Pretty much works every time, and you don't have to rely on Mr. Google.
And when it rains, you got to shut it all down?
No, actually, because the rain only comes in this little funnel, and usually people aren't digging right underneath the hole, and so we can keep digging if it rains. The only time we make people get out of the dig zone is if people are coming in and out because rocks can drop from the top, and rocks falling 80 feet will do a real number on your head. So
everybody's got hard hats on down there, obviously. So
caving helmets, yeah.
I bet the sound of thunder sounds awesome when you're in there.
It does. It sounds really cool. I've been in there during a really awful rainstorm before, and you can hear everything, but like you're completely protected. There's no wind. So it's kind of trippy. When there's a thunderstorm on the surface and you're in the cave.
Wow, are there cool echoes? Could my band play down there maybe someday?
There's not a lot of echo. I mean,
no?
Your band could play in there, but it wouldn't echo like you would think, right?
Ray, it's a round Roman amphora.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Huh, interesting.
Back to some of the large megafauna. So you said you didn't find the two mammoths.
No.
But wouldn't those be massive bones? Were they taken out by the Larry Martin excavation?
Yeah, they were. And they had a scaffolding that they used to get up and down.
Oh,
so I don't know
right.
what their method of getting things in and out was. They probably had people carry them up.
I was going to say, Larry was not a little guy, so I can't imagine. So they built a stairway all the way down. And that was dismantled and taken away.
Yes.
Actually, one of the cool things about, I know there's been work on the evolution of cheetahs, and you're finding a lot of cheetahs in there. One of the cool things, I think, one of the aspects of, pronghorns being chased by cheetahs.
Yeah.
And Kirk Johnson and I were talking about this when we went to Natural Trap Cave. He talked that pronghorns are still, they are hyper fast because it's as if they're still being chased by cheetahs, and that's why they evolved that behavior.
Well, you mean, what you're saying is that the extant pronghorns now today are faster than any animal, any
because of
that
the cheetahs
chase.
That used to chase them, which is kind of a poetic kind of thing. But perhaps cheetahs look like maybe they evolved in North America, eh?
So we are actually, so funny you should ask about this. We're actually studying this question right now. My master's student is actually looking at the American cheetah and figuring out exactly what its extent was in North America, whether there might be some mistaken cases of identity as a puma for American cheetah. And also my collaborator Penny Higgins and I are looking at whether cheetahs actually ate pronghorn or not. And so whether that just so story of the evolution of pronghorns being fast because they're being chased by cheetahs is actually truth or not.
So you can put two together. If you look at what the cheetahs were eating by the geochemistry, you can see if there's
of the teeth.
You can see if there is any, well, just anywhere in their bones, the essence of pronghorn would be there, right?
Yes. So basically, we have to look at pronghorn values, geochemical values, and then we look at the cheetah geochemical values, and if they overlap.
Wow. Then you've got the evidence for it, and this little story of my co-evolutionary forces could be faltered. All right, you're going to tell us you have the answer to it already, don't you?
We do have a preliminary answer, yeah. It's going to be in our volume
out. We don't get to know this till it comes out. When is this
but
next
I
year?
I can tell you, actually, because we presented it already at SVP.
So
preliminary results show that... Yes, pronghorns were part of the cheetah diet. They were not whole diet, but they were part of the diet. So it is possible that pronghorns were chased by cheetahs, and we've got to collect more data to know for sure. But preliminarily, it looks like it might actually be true.
So that's a cool case of evolution between predator and prey. It's driving each other so that fast cheetah, fast pronghorn. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. That's very cool.
Yeah. It's an evolutionary ghost.
It is.
That's cool.
Question. So can you go through the Pleistocene felines that existed? Smilodon, cheetah, American lion. What was there 20,000 years ago?
So no saber-toothed cats, believe it or not. We don't have any of those there. I wish we did, but I think it was too dry and open for them. They probably wanted more like trees and bushes to ambush their prey.
Or the smog of LA.
but we do have the American lion. We have the American cheetah. We have lynx. And for cats, I think that's it.
No bobcat or
well, we have a lynx. We have a lynx.
A lynx is like a bobcat.
Yeah, so we don't know whether the lynx is bobcat or whether it's Canadian lynx. We haven't done the analysis yet, but we don't have any pumas that we know of, and we don't have any saber-toothed cats.
Right.
So you've done some work at La Brea as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So saber-toothed cats and their killing technique is something that you've thought about and worked on?
Yeah, I've worked on their arms a lot.
So I'm really curious, you know, and I know there's been a lot of debate, too, about how did a saber-tooth, with those ridiculously long teeth, and they're fairly, you know, they're like sabers, they are thin, how would they kill their prey and not break their teeth? How does a saber-tooth cat bring down its prey?
So very carefully.
Yeah.
So they actually have to use their arms a lot. So one of the things that I figured out right after my dissertation was done is that Smilodon, the saber-toothed cat, has these giant, beefy forearms that are, like, super strong. They've got bone. They've got thicker bone than other cats the same size. So what we're thinking is that they basically use their arms to just absolutely press prey down.
Oh, wow.
And then they do a quick throat bite with their teeth. So they basically go in and out, basically just severing all of the blood vessels in the neck rather than suffocating.
The very soft parts.
Yeah. Rather than suffocating anybody like a modern cat would do, they just sever and they just release. And then they wait for the animal to bleed.
They bleed them out. And
yeah.
So it's really that one, that fatal bite run a neck. Wow.
Yeah.
And so they're just brutes. They just knock and... So they would ambush their prey. They're not super fast. So that's why you don't find them in natural trap cave. They'd leap on them, boom, hold them down. And then there's the delicate cut to the throat. Ah!
Yeah.
Is there any pathology, any evidence of the delicate cut to the throat of a prey animal?
There is not. And that's part of the reason why we think that's what they did, is because saber-toothed cats were evidently really good at avoiding bone with their teeth. And so there's not a lot of evidence of it, because all the damage was done to the soft tissue, more or less. Other predators are not so good at avoiding bone, right? Like dogs, hyenas, all those things eat bones. So they really do crunch on the bones. But the Smilodon just does not kill eating bone. They might eat some with their carnassials, but they don't.
What is a carnassial?
A carnassial is one of the sharp blade-like teeth in the back. They're molars.
Yeah, in front of the molars.
So one of them is a molar. The lower one is the first molar, and the upper one is their last premolar. And they're just basically like scissors. They're the scissor teeth.
Wow. Yeah.
Man, that is something to imagine.
Yeah. And isn't it, of course, it's always the soft-bodied parts that don't get preserved we have to ponder.
Yeah.
It's kind of mind-boggling to think about those huge teeth and trying to eat an animal with those big teeth in the wake.
Yeah. I think they went down like this and like the side of their face down and then
Seriously?
Cut with their teeth. Yeah. Yeah. That's probably how they ate. I mean, that's how a lot of big cats do it today, even without the big saber teeth. They just like...
They eat sideways.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if actually with those sabers, if they... And they're serrated too, right?
Some of them are, yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah, so you could kind of do a little steak knife action.
Is there a predator-prey evolution of a cat that has very small sabers, and as it grows over time, is there any predator-prey relationship to the growth of these sabers over time?
You know, that's a great question, and I can't think of anything like that. I do know that what we do hypothesize is that saber-toothed cats had prolonged parental care because of the fact that when they're young, the cubs can't hunt very well with their little baby teeth, right? And so they probably stayed with mom for a long time. And in the case of Smilodon at Rancho La Brea, we think they were social. So we think they actually lived in big familial groups or big social groups.
Wow. Hmm. I love it. I can talk about this forever. La Brea is my home comfort paleontological site because I grew up in LA, and that was it for me. Do you want to ask your really awesome question?
Yeah, I'm thinking about visiting KU now. I get to go see all those bones from...
you're close.
You are.
NTC. I'm only about an hour away. I'm in Leedsburg, Kansas.
Go and do a video along.
Yeah. No, I'm really interested in it now. But, well, thank you so much, Julian. I want to ask you this question, and we ask it of all our guests.
Mm-hmm.
What exciting epoch, what paleo period... What awesome age, what favorite fauna would you want to see if you could time travel back, only back in time? What time period would you go to and what would you want to see?
So, I mean, this one is going to be boring, but it's super easy for me.
Okay.
I mean, I am a Pleistocene girl. I want to go to the Pleistocene.
Okay.
I want to see a saber-toothed cat kill a prey animal. I want to see a Colombian mammoth. I want to see a Western camel or yesterday's camel. I want to see, I want to see a cheetah. I want to see an American cheetah, an American lion. Like these things that I've been studying for the last 20 years, I want to see these things. I really want to see them in the flesh. I want to see what they do.
Well, you just might be able to see a mammoth in our lifetime.
I heard about that. Not sure how I feel about it, but I heard about it.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, but yeah. Huh.
Yeah. It is kind of weird.
Yeah. What color?
Hold on. Well, wait. We can't just leave it there. You heard about it. Ray, do you want to say what we heard about?
What did we hear about, Dave?
Okay. A consortium, I believe, in Russia wants to resurrect a mammoth using DNA from, I think it's Colombia, a mastodon, and impregnate into an African.
No, it's,
An Indian elephant.
It's a mammoth that they're working on.
I think it's a mammoth. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a woolly or a Colombian. Yeah.
Well, that was. I was just wondering what color your American lions were. You know, that's all. Or are they?
I want to know too. I want to know. I mean,
they
I'm
might
assuming
be white, you know, to match with the snow.
It could be Dalmatian.
They might actually look like tigers. They may have stripes.
Yeah.
If they live in tall grass, you know, or right, they could be white. Like that's how they reconstruct them in the Yukon. Because it's so cold.
That's
right?
Why I've drawn them. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So, actually, before we leave this, how many more years of going to NTC are in the future for you? Is this an ongoing forever project or what?
It's an ongoing project. It takes a lot of money to go back there. So, I definitely have one more year of funding. So, for sure, we're going back in 2022, provided that, you know, we don't have another pandemic outbreak or something. But in the future, we are trying to track down ways to get more money to go back for multiple seasons if we can.
How much is a year of funding? Is it $10,000 or $50,000?
It's in between. Can you not somewhere say in between that. It's like I think we usually spend about $30,000 a season.
And how many people is that?
That's about 50 people, not all there at the same time.
Wow. And I am also wondering, too, because I'm worrying about my next meal. When you go down there, is like a full food service down there?
Didn't you watch the video?
Are there sandwiches?
We have to pack our own lunches.
Your own lunch. I thought there'd be a little buffet over there.
Well, my partner, John, who actually is also an evolutionary biologist, but he's a molecular biologist, he's sort of the camp cook / manager. So he does a lot of our meals for us.
I'm going to befriend him. And so if Dave and I show up in our Paleo Nerd t-shirts and we volunteer for an afternoon, could we like do a deal with you?
Sure.
Yeah, we'll get to clean up and wash up. We'll do KP.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You got to get up the hill first though, Ray.
Oh, yeah. I'm afraid of that.
At your age. Okay, let me ask my question. Now, there's been debate as to why the North American megafauna became extinct at the end of the Pleistocene. Now, one theory says it was human-caused through hunting, the overkill hypothesis. But a more widely accepted idea is that it was climate change. The end of the last glaciation coincided with the megafaunal extinction. Mm-hmm. Julie, you've excavated that boundary. You've spent 5 field seasons in Natural Trap Cave amongst the deposition. And obviously, you must have, in a downtime or a moment of epiphany, you've pondered the ecology of the Pleistocene-Holocene boundary. Yeah. What do you think?
It's a hard question because I don't think that anybody knows for sure. But I will say this. I will say that climate does a whole lot of weird stuff at the end of the Pleistocene. It gets really dry and really warm really fast. And I think that is a big deal. I also think that there is some record that there are human-mediated events also going on at that time. So I think it's actually, I don't think it's overkill by humans. What I think might be happening is that the hot and dry climate change is being exacerbated by humans modifying their environment rather than overkilling animals. Not to say that...
You mean fires?
Yeah, like fires, for example. I don't necessarily think that humans were not killing animals. I mean, I don't have any data on that, so I can't really comment on how much animal killing was going on. But humans probably did play some role, although maybe it wasn't the role that everybody thinks it was.
How fast did the North America go from ice-covered landmass to warm and dry?
Within a couple thousand years, which doesn't seem like very long, but for geological time, it's super short, the temperature raised at least 6 degrees Celsius.
That's drastic.
Yeah.
Huh. And so you could see, can you actually see from the pollen count?
Yes.
The shrubbery changing, the landscape literally changing?
Absolutely. You can see the change immediately in the pollen. And in things like sediment, like lake sediments, you can see this change happening as well.
Hey, I think this has been a really fun interview. Thank you, Julie, so much for joining us on Paleo Nerds. And you know what? You're going to get a Paleo Nerd t-shirt out of this.
That's amazing. That is totally worth it. I actually just had a lot of fun talking to you guys, too. Thanks for contacting me. Thanks for interviewing me. I loved it.
Our pleasure. Well, thank you so much. We'll see you in Des Moines.
Sounds good.
NTC, I'm going to be that guy showing up. I'm here.
All right. Come on
I'll
out.
Let you know. Hey, Julie, thanks so much, and we'll see you around.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was awesome because I could just imagine these animals falling into this pit and dying, and not dying all at once, but lingering for a week with a broken leg.
It's sad, and it's so kind of scary. There's going to be like a vibe in that cave, man, that's like death.
Oh, yeah.
Death, yeah. Man. I don't know. It would kind of creep me out. Just, I don't know. It is the place of death in Wyoming.
Yeah, but any fossil site is the place of death, right?
Yeah, this is the same spot over and over and over, Dave. It's cursed.